Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. On the show, we continue to build awareness of the United Nations agenda for the 21st century. ICLEI, the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, and almost everything else labeled smart, such as smart growth, smart cities, smart cars, smartphones, smart meters, smart water, and so on. There are long-term plans being carried out in your city, your community, and your neighborhood. And they're paid for through your taxpayer funds. For example, past guest, investigative journalist Stacy Lynn, uncovered the Fort Collins, Colorado budget anomalies, such as $800,000 a year to tell you how to feel on a nature walk, or about $800,000 a year for a class to learn the difference between an incandescent bulb and a CFL bulb. The mercury toxicity in the CFL bulb is not mentioned in these classes. We're joined today by returning guest Andrew Johnson, who states Agenda 21's success relies on people not thinking of connections. They must not entertain control and deception of this magnitude. The connections include the suppression of free energy, climate engineering, and weather warfare. Andrew runs the website Check the Evidence. He's the author of the book 9/11 Finding the Truth, which is a free download at his site. Andrew has done extensive research into what happened to the World Trade Center towers on September 11, 2001, the manufactured wars on terror, anti-gravity, free energy, and climate engineering. He lives in North Yorkshire, England, and has worked as a software engineer, but now works with disabled students, assessing them for higher education assistance. Andrew, welcome back to In Other News.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Jeff.
Well, you've included the work of investigative journalist Stacy Lynn and forensics real estate appraiser and author Rosa Corey into your research. I think they're among the important researchers to emphasize that breakthrough a lot of the Agenda 21 propaganda. And Stacy says she started to research carbon dioxide. And if you look at the U.S. Department of Carbon Dioxide Information Analysis Center, she says they'll tell you how much CO2 is in the Earth's atmosphere. She said she wanted to know why we were so focused on it and why we're interested in reducing those levels. The department, she says, states that the total amount of CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere is 0.38%. And she says scientists note those levels are naturally decreasing. What are your thoughts on the value of those statements and Stacy Lynn's research into bringing awareness of budgetary discretions related to Agenda 21 in Fort Collins, Colorado?
Well, just on there's a couple of specifics I don't know a lot about. Certainly the carbon dioxide issue is obviously, you know, you do look into that. And yes, the figure that you came out with there, which I think is expressed in another way, is 0.03% of the atmosphere. And the focus has primarily been on that in much of the public sort of debates around the issue. And it turns out that that actually itself is essentially a meaningless figure. So, you know, you've got many, many scientists and politicians arguing about something which actually has no relevance at all to what has been happening within the atmosphere. They based government policies on this. But as for the Fort Collins, I don't really know anything about that particularly. All I can say is obviously I'm over in the UK, and we have seen our lifestyles being affected by this talk of carbon dioxide increases in the atmosphere due to human activity.
Anything specific that you could mention how your lifestyle has been affected?
Well, it's essentially in terms of, for example, I can hire a car the company that I've used in the past is called Enterprise Car Rental, which I think operates in the US as well. And you can go onto there and you can pay a rate for your car rental, and then there's another box that you can tick, which says something like offset your carbon emissions. And then if you tick that box, I think you pay an extra sort of $5 or something for the daily rental. So that's one example where that comes right onto a web page, you know. But then after that, there are various these things are thrust at you from all directions in terms of, you know, you're encouraged to use less energy. One of the things we discussed before the program a little bit were things like smart meters, and a lot of that is geared to reducing CO2 emissions. And for example, you'll see there's a well-known retailer in the UK here called Marks and Spencers, and they have these trucks. The truck is like a curved, it's got a curved shape, and then they have a big banner on the truck, you know, big paint job saying, we've reduced our carbon emissions by 12% with this truck, you know, and this is plan B, because this is plan A, because there is no plan B, you know, as in there's no plan B because we're all going to die, you know, and it, you know, and these things are thrust at you from all directions. I haven't had something really direct, but certain taxes have been raised, and certain business taxes have been raised, and the green agenda has been advanced here too, in much the same way as in other countries.
Are there any researchers similar to Rosa Corey or Stacey Lynn in the UK that you know of?
I don't know of anyone particularly. I know that Rosa Corey has... she has been quite very, very well organised with her and a small group of people in terms of, you know, going to these Agenda 21 meetings and basically disrupting them. Or even if she doesn't disrupt them, she will illustrate to people that are there that there is something else going on other than what these meetings are, you know, purported to be, you know, the purpose of them. There's something else other than their stated purpose going on. I don't know of anyone personally who has done that in the UK. You know, I can't speak for them. I haven't really done it. I haven't become aware of any specific meetings in my local area, you know, which are to do with the same thing. Although I would think, I certainly discovered in my own research, Agenda 21 type statements and language. And there was one particular reference that Rosa Corey said, you know, would be in local government planning documents, and I found that similar sort of statement in my own local borough council here in the UK. So, you know, she's perfectly accurate in bringing this to people's attention.
For listeners, Rosa Corey is a real estate appraiser, and she's author of the book Behind the Green Mask, UN Agenda 21. She's been a past guest and I think one of the most effective communicators about the perils of Agenda 21 activity. Have you noticed, Andrew, that in articles such as the one titled Agenda 21, the UN Conspiracy That Just Won't Die, it's a report... It mentions how the Southern Poverty Law Center is deconstructing the myth of Agenda 21 and characterizing those who criticize sustainability projects such as conspiracy theorists. A lot of these types of articles seem to use a recognizable face such as Glenn Beck to easily discredit, meaning that Glenn Beck allows himself to appear at times unstable on television, and it's easy to associate the Agenda 21 critique with that personality, like someone not in their right mind, a conspiracy theorist. I think it's effective in a way to get intellectual fence-sitters not wanting to associate themselves with this personality and then subsequently those views. But that's assuming the reader won't form an opinion from objective research. This appears to get the topic run up in the gears of bipartisan viewpoints and missing the big picture. Can you talk about the divisive tactics used around climate change and Agenda 21?
Well, yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's certainly something that I've seen from Rosa Corey's videos. I mean, she has one particular one which comes to mind, which seems to be very similar to the sort of methods that you just described. And I referenced this in the Agenda 21 presentation that I put together last year. And Rosa Corey, she was interviewed by Andrew Reinbeck. She was then giving all the information to Andrew Reinbeck, and he was a reporter for the Huffington Post. And she was giving all, you know, the statements about it, and then he asked her what she thought about that, and she described it as the plan, you know, to control all land, all people, all resources, and all education in the world. You know, it's a comprehensive plan. She told him all of that, and she explained why. And then when it came to the article that he was doing about Agenda 21, he didn't even mention that he'd interview her and didn't give her any of the information. And instead, much as the as you referenced there with the Glenn Beck type of thing, he just referred to this John Birch Society talking about a New World Order and Agenda 21. That was, I mean, Rosa Corey didn't even mention the John Birch Society. So it's exactly the same thing. When this thing sort of filters through to the mainstream a bit, they always have to put this spin on it to make it look like people that are trying to pull these things apart and get to the bottom of them are actually either mentally unstable or just not very good researchers or, you know, whatever the excuse is to try and paint them in a bad light.
What usually comes through as to maybe getting the pulse of what the general readership of these articles seems to be are the comments at the bottom of some of these articles. And you could scroll down through some of the comments and you see through reading that most people get it. They understand that there is severe manipulation going on, even aware of the geoengineering. This seems to be a really good consensus of awake people. However, a lot of these articles coming out, they don't have a comment section. And especially the ones in The Guardian or bigger newspapers that have, you know, this kind of spin. There's another article in the Chicago Tribune recently, analysis. Trump's climate change shift is really about killing the international order. And there's a quote, but anti-government conservatives such as Phyllis Schlafly and Tom DeWeese latched onto the measure as a symbol of a much broader UN-backed conspiracy to take control of America. DeWeese, whose think tank focuses on the UN and its effect on American national sovereignty, has described Agenda 21 as a, quote, blueprint to turn your community into a little Soviet. There's a comment. I just took one of the comments out and picks a quote out of the article. Quote, climate change denial is not incidental to a nationalist populist agenda. It's central to it, and that's not a coincidence. And so the commenter rephrases it. Climate change is not incidental to an internationalist redistributionist agenda. It's central to it, and that's not a coincidence. So people understand that they're being tricked by the very reporters and journalists who are responsible to give a non-biased report.
Well, indeed, and I think this Huffington Post article was an example of that, you know, in the same sort of way that they try to marginalize people who are questioning what this Agenda 21 is and how it is being implemented and what's behind it. And as Rosa Corey, you know, again, she does a very good job of highlighting the issues of, you know, communitarianism, in that when you start to throw out this vernacular that comes along with Agenda 21, such as smart growth, you know, and smart meters and sustainability and these sorts of phrases, they then get adopted by the wider community. And quite soon, you are looking at a loss of individual rights. And if you try and stand up for your own individual rights, you're regarded as a troublemaker. And I think the way that that works in the US is a little bit different to the way that it works here in the UK, because the UK doesn't have a written constitution, at least not in the same way that the US does, which makes certain statements about individual rights. So we don't get quite the same situation here in the UK as you do in the US, where many people are standing up for their individual rights, you know, for life, liberty, and love and happiness, and those sorts of rights. We don't quite have that same basis here, but nevertheless, the same sort of thing is going on here. We have this thing here. I don't think, and I use this as you mentioned just before the interview, we have this thing here called common purpose, and this appears to be a type of brainwashing which has been done in business, academic, and political circles. And they have their own website, and this group claims to be a charity which is providing training for leadership. But when you actually look into what this group is doing and who's done their training, it becomes very clear that this is not entirely what it's set, laid out to be. It's something else. Again, there's another something else going on in the background. And I was quite interested to find out when I was writing this article that Common Purpose, this group in the UK, were promoting the idea of smart cities. And this smart city idea is also something which is an Agenda 21 type of language, in that the city should be run in certain ways and have certain measures put in place to make sure that things are done in a sustainable way, environmentally friendly, and all of that green language. But it ultimately, as again we discussed a little bit before the interview, is down to restricting the individual rights and imposing more apparatus of control on people, or not so much imposing it immediately, but bringing it in and acclimatizing people to it, so that before too long, the individual freedoms have pretty much disappeared, and you're into basically a form of global communism, which has come from essentially a type of eco-fascism, really. It's how I've come to understand it.
You write in on your website, who wouldn't want to protect the environment and make it sustainable? And can you break that down a little bit in terms of the propaganda element?
Yeah, certainly. And I think this is one of, to me, when you start to unpick that issue, it proves that the Agenda 21 agenda is a lie. It is not what it is claimed to be. It's not to do with being green and sustainably using resources. It's not about that at all. And the reason that you can come to know that is if you start to look into how energy is used and how other people have actually tried to improve our usage of energy, and all efforts to do that have actually been stopped. And this is where you get, energy sources which are truly sustainable, to use their own language, sustainable to the point that they will never run out. They are infinite energy sources. And we'll maybe talk about that in a bit. But to give you a couple of more conventional examples, I like to get people to go and watch a film which is a few years old now, if they can find it. It's called Who Killed the Electric Car? This was, I think, quite a well-funded film. I've got certain sort of nagging doubts about the film, but what it shows is still an important story of the electric car in the US, or an electric car, I should say, which I think was brought out in 1991. It's a while since I've watched this film, so I might get some of the dates and the times a little bit out. And it was General Motors who decided that they wanted to build an electric car. And they had a basic specification that this car needed to have a range of at least, I think it was 100 miles or 150 miles before it needed charging up. So they spent quite a few years designing this, and then they needed to get a special type of battery technology, because what they had, at that point when they were designing it, wasn't good enough. And so they went to this company, and I think it was like a Polish guy who developed this sort of quite advanced battery system, and they ended up licensing his technology or getting him to manufacture these batteries for the EV1. Now, as it turned out, they developed this car, and it was pretty good, and it would do like 60, 70 miles an hour and a range of 100 miles, and they were quite happy with the battery performance. But what I didn't realize when I first heard this story is that they didn't actually sell these cars. They leased them, so people weren't allowed to buy them. And they put them out on a lease scheme. Then, after I think they'd been out a couple of years, people really liked these cars. they really liked them because they were quiet, they were clean, you know, they could drive into work and sit in a queue of traffic, and they were silent, didn't create any pollution, and then they could charge them when they got to work, or they could charge them up when they got home, and they were brilliant. And then at one point they said, right, well, we're not actually going to put this into general use now, we're going to recall all the cars. And people were saying, wait, we want to buy them, how much do you want, you know, we'll give you the money. And said, no, you can't buy them, we're going to take them off you, and you've got to return it to this depot by this date, or, you know, there'll be trouble. And the people were so, they liked the EV1 so much that they actually were protesting outside the depot, because these cars were there for weeks and months, you know, and they weren't doing anything with them, and they wouldn't say what they were going to do with them, or really why they'd been withdrawn, and why can't we have them back. And there was a whole big long campaign which I think went on for a year, 2 years. It's all in the film, this information. And eventually they took these cars away from the depot, and they crushed them, and I think they buried some of them in a desert or something, somewhere part of the desert. It's all in the film. But there was nothing wrong with these cars. You know, they were perfectly workable, perfectly legitimate, and they were just advanced battery technology that was in use. You know, there wasn't any Tesla technology or anything like that. So clearly there was something else going on. In the film, it suggests that it was the oil industry who, you know, had their own spies and whatnot that were working within General Motors to crush the project and make sure it didn't progress, because it was too much of a threat to the use of oil. And maybe that's true, and I think there's some evidence that that was true. If you watch the film, it goes through some of that. But the point about that is that since, I think it was 91, 92, 93, so we're talking 20 years ago this all transpired. I mean, since then, we've really only seen a few hybrid car models. I don't know what it's like in the US, but we've had a few models here in the UK that have come out that are hybrids. They still, you know, you still put gas in them, but the gas engine charges up a battery as well. So you've got a charge range of about 100 or 200 miles, but then after that, you have to use gas again. So they're not really... You know, they're only a little bit different to the normal gasoline or diesel cars that you get. So that, to me, proves when that sort of project isn't encouraged and they don't move over to something like some type of advanced battery technology, that right there is a red flag that they're not actually interested in producing a sustainable, energy form of energy to be used in transport. And the other one which I put in the article, I didn't put about the EV1 in the Uncommon Purpose article, the other one which I became aware of a good few years ago now, is Bob Lazar. Bob Lazar's car, he's famous for people that may know listening to your program. He is the chap that claims to have worked in Area 51 on the back-engineered flying saucer propulsion system. And some people think he's made that story up. Some people think he's, you know, 100% sincere and he's telling the truth. I have certain doubts about elements of that story, but I think the basis of it, I think, is probably true. But completely separate to all of that, Bob Lazar is a clever guy. He is a clever inventor. And he developed a system for storing hydrogen in a hydride, which is like a solid material. So he could generate hydrogen gas using a solar powered generator which was at home. The gas would bubble out of the generator and then it would go into these tubes, and then it would be stored in what's called a metal hydride. It's like a solid material. And what would then happen to get the hydrogen back out again? You just heat up this material slightly, so maybe, I know, 60 or 100 degrees or something Celsius, and then the hydrogen would come out and you could burn it. And he developed this system over several years, but the only problem with it is that it used what's called a weapons-grade material. It used a material that could only be produced in a particle accelerator. And so whichever government department was in the US, they banned it. They banned him from selling this. And even when he tried to get around that with various, rejigging the system, they just kept putting in front of him health and safety regulations, so he could never get the system released. And there's a video about this. You know, you can watch him sort of going through this and showing the system working. I think the video is probably 8, 9, 10 years old by now, something like that. So this was another system, all conventional technology. The only key to it was this metal hydride storage system that he developed. Didn't need to burn gas. You could get all this fuel from solar energy. That's how he made it. No problem. Yet it was suppressed. You know, so that again proves that this is not about producing energy sustainably. It's about controlling people.
Yes, and getting back to that question in your article, who wouldn't want to protect the environment and make it sustainable? And there it is. And, you know, it made me think about the many products that, despite their unpopularity, are pushed into the public domain. Google Glass is one example I can think of. In the past few years, self-driving cars. And I don't know if there was ever a public demand for a self-driving car. Is there a connection to Agenda 21, smart vehicles and smart cities here?
Well, that's a very good observation, Jeff. You know, and I think your point that you make about the self-driving car, and I, you know, tutor on a course where this came up as a subject last year, and one of the points that was made about the self-driving car is that people wouldn't like it because of the loss of control. That's exactly what we're talking about, a loss of control. So, yes, this idea that Google might be, or whoever it might be, pushing a driverless car does indeed fit into this idea that, you know, you live in a city, you're transported around the place. You know, some cities now, as we know, the center of the city, that no cars are allowed. Certainly the city nearest to me has pedestrian areas right in the center where you can't have many cars, if any, or you can only take them in there to do deliveries and things. So we've seen that increasing trend here in the UK where car transport has been restricted, and now we've had this thing with taxis as well. There's a chap that I know that works as you call them cabs. He works as a cab driver in London. And he has had certain controls placed on him and certain guidelines that have been put into place. And when he read my article, because I've talked to this chap over several years, and he realized that these regulations that have gradually been coming into his, you know, area of work with his driving his cab, they fit in with the Agenda 21 type methodology to basically shut out independent operators, and you'll just have like corporate cab firms, like this cab firm called Uber, which is operating in Europe. It's a big corporate firm which runs taxis through web pages. So you'll go onto a web page and, you know, put in your details, and it'll give you a taxi and so forth. So that all fits in with this monitoring, tracking, surveillance agenda. Same with driverless cars. If you've got a driverless car, it's going to be probably logged into a a web server somewhere, getting its navigation data and its traffic data from a satellite, and probably uploading stuff back. Much as if you have a mobile phone and you switch on your Google, you know, thing on your mobile phone, your Google Map thing on there, your position is uploaded to Google if you've got it switched on, which you have to, I think, to have the GPS running, and so that they can use your positional data to update their systems. So you are being tracked, you know. So that all fits in to this smart grid agenda, this smart type of grid agenda, definitely.
It's interesting to me because instead of free energy and maybe hydrogen-driven vehicles, as you were discussing with Bob Lazar's work, they're developing cars to drive for you, and maybe some are electric hybrids, maybe some use straight gasoline, but no transition into a free energy system here. You mentioned in your article the Lutec device. Could you tell listeners what that is?
Oh, certainly, yes. I mean, that brings us on to the other area where we're talking about truly sustainable energy sources, where you don't have to, you know, I mean, you just temporarily going back to the electric car, one of the things which is often overlooked And I think it's why they are so expensive here, because if you get a gasoline car, it might be like, let's say, £15,000 or something for a new gasoline car here. But to get an equivalent of that, which is the battery version, it might be £20,000 or £25,000. And the point about it is that the battery in that car will only last, I think it's either 5 or 10 years, and then you have to get a new battery system, which is thousands of pounds. So that isn't sustainable, because you've then got to replace all that material, whether that's some type of lithium-ion battery, or whether it's some derivative of a lead-acid battery, or some hybrid technology with other things. You know, it's all physical material. It's got to be mined, it's got to be manufactured, it's got to be all of that. But something like this Lutec device is a free energy device. It produces energy essentially from nowhere, which physics claims is impossible, but there are a number of examples where you can see that it's not impossible. I won't go into all of that. But the Lutec device was basically, it's like a self-running motor. It's sort of like a dynamo and a motor coupled together in some clever way. And so you generate some power in one side of the device, feed it into the other, and you get that power back plus a little bit extra. And the way that it works, I think, is it switches, if I remember, it's a while since I've looked at the details of this, but it switches between DC and AC, so that it's direct current or alternating current. I think one half is direct current, the other half is alternating current, and it works in some unusual way. And the creator of the device, I have a presentation where I play the news clip where he's interviewed, and this is developed in Australia, the Lutec device. And he's a very sort of calm, staid sort of guy. And he says to the reporter, well, I know people are going to say that this doesn't work, but everyone that's actually been to see our device and they've tested it themselves, they agree that it does work. All the people that say it doesn't work haven't actually been to see it, they haven't seen it running, they haven't asked us. And this is, again, is the common type of thread, that they don't actually look at the device, they don't investigate how it works, they don't go and see it. They just say, it can't possibly work, so therefore I'm not going to see it. This is among the academic community. And my understanding of what happened with this device, it came on the scene quite a long time ago. I think it was around about 2001 that they first started showing this to people. And I think by about 6 years later, 5 or 6 years later, that when they did this news broadcast, which I think was 2007 sort of time, they got a fairly good prototype together by then, which was, they could show would, I think, generate 5 kilowatts of electricity from, essentially from thin air, you know. The news report interviews another investor and an independent engineering consultant, and he said he tested it and it does work, and he wasn't quite sure how it worked, but he did agree it did work. Then a few years after that, they tried to get the thing, money put into the thing, and it just disappeared. And then the last time I checked, the website had gone. You know, they used to have a website called lutec.com.au. You might be able to find that in the Internet Archive if you want to go and look for it, but it had disappeared. And somebody told me, and I didn't check up on this, that the sister of the inventor was mysteriously killed around the time they were trying to, move forward with some business dealings. And this, you know, this is exactly the sort of thing that happened with Stan Meyer and his water fuel cell, which was a long-running battle that he had with people over that, which ran from, I think, the mid-80s up to about 2003 when Meyer was killed. He was poisoned. So what we have, if you start to investigate those devices, and I've just given a couple there, and I could probably, probably list 7 or 8 more at least, you see that these devices, what happens is a prototype is built, a prototype works, and in fact, I went to see a chap last year who lives not too far from here, lives about 50 miles from here, and he had built some type of similar device. I didn't get to see all the measurements, but it looked like he was working on something similar. But the problem with his device was he could only run it for about 10 minutes or 5 minutes, and then it would overheat, and the bearings would overheat, because he'd manufactured this thing himself. You know, he'd built it all in his workshop, and the tolerances on it weren't that good, you know. And this is the problem. You can build these devices, But to run them for an hour and a half, you can't get more out of them than that. So if people, you'll see people on the internet saying, well, if this device works, why aren't they running their house office off their device? The answer is because it doesn't work for long enough. It doesn't run 24/7. They haven't got an advanced machine tool shop like you'd have, say, you know, in a car manufacturing plant where you manufacture parts to a, you know, 1/10,000th of an inch tolerance. They don't have access to that sort of equipment. So the prototypes that they build, typically, if they're mechanical, this is, will only run for a few minutes, producing free energy, and then they, you know, the bearings will get hot, and they have to switch them off, or else it'll break, and they'll have to build another one, you know.
And so you were mentioning the Lutec device. You mentioned cold fusion. Dr. Judy Wood says room temperature fusion.
Yes.
Stan Meyer's water fuel cell, and you also mentioned Dr. T. Henry Moray's radiant energy device, and of course, elements of Nikola Tesla's work. And regarding the suppression of energy, we've had a past guest on, Patrick Kelly. He's a former civil engineer living in the UK, and he put together a PDF called Free Energy Devices. It's about a million words, and he went around and consolidated as many free energy devices as possible into this PDF. And we often give that away as a premium within the archives of the show, and we'll put that on there as a bonus ebook. He mentioned the same thing that you just did regarding the Lutec device. The sister of the inventor was killed mysteriously. That's what he said. He said there were people who put the Joe cell on their vehicle. They don't need to use gasoline anymore. They have a Joe cell. It works, and they're fine-tuning it. They'll get approached by people, and he said this one individual was approached who had a Joe cell on his vehicle and handed him a dossier of the whereabouts of his family the past 2 weeks.
Wow. Yeah.
Under the weight of murder, basically, you're going to die if you continue to do this. Your loved ones will die.
Yeah, I mean, these are the sort of tactics that these people seem to be employing. And I've heard this story several times over. There's a video clip which I came across a few years ago which tells a similar story. I think it's a chap either in Australia or New Zealand, and he had also developed some device which meant that he could run his car on, you know, next to no fuel or water or, you know, solar power or something. There's a chap in the video telling this story that he knew this guy. He'd seen the car working. He'd had, probably even had a ride in it or something. And then he met this chap one day, and he said, I've had people saying I shouldn't be doing this, you know, but I'm just going to ignore them. They said that he was found dead on the train tracks, you know, and he'd stumbled onto these train tracks drunk, and he was killed by a train, you know. And the chap that was telling the story said he knew the chap quite well, and he knew he didn't drink. You know, he wouldn't have done that. So it's the same sort of story that you get these threats put onto people, and I think it's an indication of how important the suppression of free energy is, because it undermines the green agenda, and it undermines the Agenda 21, you know, scenario completely, and that's what I put into the article. And I suppose my reason for doing that is that there are quite a few people who are talking about Agenda 21. They are talking about climate change, but they are not tying that together with the suppression of free energy. And if you couple the two together, then it becomes clearer what Agenda 21 and similar things are all about, and why perhaps there's been an increased, you know, activity on the suppression of such free energy devices. We go on from there to the ongoing geoengineering, which I know you've covered as well before. I think that's also another thing that the people who talk about Agenda 21 and also, you know, you typically get the polarized Hegelian debate between, no, it's not carbon dioxide that's the problem. Yes, it is carbon dioxide the problem. Or, no, water vapor is the biggest greenhouse gas, not carbon dioxide. Yes, we know that, but carbon dioxide is still the one that's most produced by fumes from cars and factories, so that's, you know, what the real deal is. And you'll get that whole, you know, thing going on. It's been going on for over 20 years now, But what you don't get is, oh, look at that strange cloud in the sky. Look, there's a circular hole in that cloud. And as I've seen, there are many pictures now that you can see with circular holes in clouds. And I've witnessed these cloud anomalies myself. I've photographed them on many occasions. I've got collections. A few people send them to me. But so when you see these cloud anomalies, to me that makes the whole debate about is this, you know, is this carbon dioxide, is it man, is it water vapor? No, it's irrelevant. Clearly, we have now plenty of evidence that there is some type of technology being employed to alter the weather, and it's nothing to do with burning fuels, and it's nothing to do with ordinary human activity, you know, from factories belching out fumes or too many cars on the roads and whatnot.
I want to add in, I mentioned before the comment section below articles, and especially the articles that are designed essentially as propaganda, saying that climate engineering, it may be necessary to stave off a warming planet with additional CO2 being pumped into the air, into the atmosphere. And below those articles, you'll see in the comments, the consensus is that people know it's BS. The actual weather control technology on a mass scale across the planet is being deployed. And there were articles, one was titled "Cloudy with a Chance of Contrails, NASA Clears Up Skies with New Fuel." And there was another one titled "Harvard Scientists Move Ahead on Plans for Atmospheric Geoengineering Experiments." And there was a paragraph in this article, "Only two known experiments have been carried out in the open air to date that could be considered geoengineering related. University of California, San Diego researchers sprayed smoke and salt particles off the coast of California as part of the EPEACE experiments in 2011, and scientists in Russia dispersed aerosols from a helicopter and car in 2009. Very depressing to see they're allowed to spread this propaganda out there into the public domain. What are your thoughts on that specifically?
Oh, yeah, Jeff. I mean, that's something which I've observed happening for about nine years now. And there's a few. I did look at those articles, or I didn't read the whole things, but I've seen similar articles. And one of the faces that was near the top of one of those articles was Dr. David Keith. And I think he was originally at the University of Calgary, but I think he's now, I can't remember, it says in the article which university he was working with at the moment.
I think he's at Harvard.
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah. And but I think he was originally with the University of Calgary. Well, that makes any difference to what we're going to talk about, but he patented some type of technique, which was these barium titanate discs, which were, I think, something like 10 nanometers across, which, you know, very tiny, you know, I don't know, half the width of a human hair or something like that, or even less. And he's got this, there's a PowerPoint you can find that he did. It's a few years old now. Maybe I think it was done like 2010 or something like that. And I stole one of these slides to put in my presentation, which where I talk about what he's mentioning here, because it's to do with this, you know, this stratospheric aerosol, you know, spraying. Because one of the proposed aerosols was the barium titanate substance which he'd come up with. And the thing about this was that it was a disc that you could make, you know, with some process. And it would be reflective, so it would reflect a proportion of the sunlight, you know, which was in incident upon it. But the thing about it was, is it, because it was barium titanate, it would be self-levitating, because the Earth's electrical field at that certain height would be such that it would, you know, it would induce a charge on this barium titanate disc, which meant that it would then create sufficient electrical field or something to levitate. So, in other words, it would stay in the atmosphere, you know, very much longer under normal conditions than it would if it wasn't a barium titanate disc, and that's why he'd chosen this material. So he goes into quite a lot of detail. And so this David Keith is obviously clearly a very competent and clever chap, but he is not taking into account all the evidence. the whole thing with the chemtrail issue, which I've been following for about 10 years, well, 12 years now, actually, since I first took a photograph of one grid outside my house, above my house. It, that, again, has been subject to a lot of disinformation put onto the internet and mixed together with David Keith. There was one particularly interesting clip which gave me a funny feeling. This was about 4 or 5 years ago when David Keith was on with Mr. Colbert, Stephen Colbert, who's sort of a satirical news commentator. And he was on Stephen Colbert's program, and they were talking about geoengineering and these stratospheric aerosols. And then Stephen Colbert just sort of says, that sort of thing that you're talking about there sounds like these chemtrails to me. You know, David Keith smiles, you know, and they exchange some glances, you know, or something. I think this clip, it would still be on YouTube if people want to go and look for it. And I was highly suspicious of this because I can't imagine somebody like Stephen Colbert, you know, on mainstream TV, probably have millions of viewers, he would disclose the presence of a clandestine chemical spraying program in that way. To me, that was misdirection, because I think that by and large, the trails are not toxic. I'm not saying all of them are non-toxic, but I think what we're seeing is something else, some other program that's going on, particularly when you consider that some of these trails are done over the sea. Some of the patterns, for example, are very odd. And I know that in the past, I mentioned this in the presentation I put together in 2014 called Chemtrails and Climate. Scott Stevens, he talks about the trails being used as markers, as grids, you know, and this, I think, might possibly be the function of these grids. It's not to lay down a grid of toxic spray. It's more to act as some kind of marker for monitoring the way that the atmosphere is behaving in response to whatever technology is being used to modify the atmosphere. And, of course, some people think that this is HAARP. I'm not too sure about that. And there's various versions of HAARP around the globe. Some people think it's these Gwen towers or these NEXRAD systems, which are I'm not sure about that. I haven't studied that in a lot of detail, but that's a possibility. I'm tending towards the view that this technology that's being employed, I think at least some of it, it must be in space somewhere. It must be in, because if it's in space, you wouldn't see it. People wouldn't be able to access it. They can't see it. They don't know where it is. It's out of the way. It can't be interfered with very easily, not by common people anyway. So I suspect that we've got, and I can't prove this, it is just speculation, that there is something up in space which is producing effects in the atmosphere. I'm having difficulty understanding why we're seeing these circular cloud holes and various other forms. And in fact, the other thing that I was going to mention, going back to these articles that come out, like the ones you mentioned, mm-hmm. I'll send you this link, actually, because somebody sent this to me about 3 or 4 days ago. We've now had something that's come out in the UK where they've decided now to put, I think, something like 25 or 26 new types of cloud into the cloud classification catalogue, or the cloud atlas, I think they called it. Why would that be? Why have we suddenly got 28 new types of cloud that need to go in this cloud atlas, this official cloud atlas? And this is part of a normalization program where they have to sort of say, oh, yeah, we've got these new clouds now. And certainly in one of the articles that is about this, it's in this Guardian newspaper, one of the UK ones, they mention at the end, you know, they bring in the climate change. They bring in, there's a reference to something like, they call it Cirrus Homogenitus, which, I presume is some Latin for generated by man, you know, so. And they actually include a very substantial grid of chemtrails or contrails, which are whatever you want to call them, in this article. And they claim that this has just been put in the cloud atlas. Why? You know, it's very, very sad that they are trying to normalize this. In fact, while we're on that subject, the other thing which I mentioned a couple of years ago, and I think, again, it was somebody else that sent me this clip, I put this into the presentation. Everyone is probably familiar with the Wimbledon Tennis Championships, the unofficial sort of World Tennis Championships, which are held in London every year. The BBC here does quite comprehensive coverage, as you may well imagine, and they have during Wimbledon tournament, which is in June, towards the end of June, I think last week of June, first week of July normally, around then, and they have a nightly coverage program, to cover all the day's matches and highlights and so forth. And in 2013, they introduced a new opening sequence, for the program, showing all the popular tennis players of the day, and sort of slow motion serves and superimposed with 3D versions, views of the stand and everything. And in every single shot with a tennis player in the background, wherever there is a portion of sky, which is in most of the shots, they have trails in them, every single shot. And it is very, very noticeable. And this, to me, is normalizing the appearance of these trails in the sky subliminally and subconsciously. You can see multiple examples of this.
Well, Andrew, there's so much more to talk about. You have also written about, in your article, Uncommon Purpose, Agenda 22, you include health treatments, and you write, the same dark forces that are pushing Agenda 21 and similar programs are the most likely culprits for suppressing technologies, which would completely resolve the problems Agenda 21 is meant to address. It would be great to have you back on to talk about the health treatments and that realm. I want to thank you for being on the show to talk about these important areas of Agenda 21 and specifically your research. If people would like to see that presentation that you had put together on Agenda 21, how could they see it?
Yes, well, you can go to checktheevidence.com, and I think if you just put the word subversion into the search box there, it will come up. The presentation is also on YouTube. It's 3 one-hour segments approximately, and it's called The Subversion Agenda, where I go into more detail about what we've talked about tonight. I think parts of it are blocked. I know that somebody tried to watch it, and they were either getting that too many adverts or part of it was blanked out. So if anybody wants to write to me, and I can send them a DVD of it, no problem. And just go on to checktheevidence.com, go on to the contact button and send me a message if you like, and I will try and oblige you with either a link or a DVD or something, and hopefully you can get the information that way.
So we covered free energy. We need to cover anti-gravity and, of course, the black technology, but in the context of where we are evolving, or how we are evolving as a human race, and what are the elements of suppression. Andrew Johnson, I want to thank you for being on In Other News. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me, Jeff.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again next Monday, 11 p.m.
Spidery fingers of industry reach for the sky. Brick upon brick, stone upon stone, they grow, choking the atmosphere oh so incredibly slowly. Sulfur and carbon and hydrogen sulfide and lime favor corrosion and cover your cities with grime. Something is killing the land before your eyes, and the sunshine is not to blame. Could be the insane, inhumane games we play. Day. Rivers. mushrooming home in a crowd. I am alone. Close your eyes, lie still.